Hello, everyone. I'm Viviana Young, the Environmental Education and Outreach Leader for Umpqua Watersheds through United Communities AmeriCorps, and the host of Living Downstream.
Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives that different people have to offer and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute. We acknowledge that the land upon which Umpqua Watersheds is located was formerly occupied and tended by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Molalla, and others. Their history is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity towards the natural environment, which indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement.
Our guest for today is Cindy Hawes, a professor at Umpqua Community College and the founder of Umpqua Natural Leadership Science Hub, also known as UNLEASH. Hello, Cindy.
Hi there.
So could you start us off by telling us about UNLEASH? What is it?
Okay, UNLEASH is Umpqua Natural Leadership Science Hub. And it's a nonprofit that was formed in 2016. Years of teaching at community college level, as well as secondary education levels, it was pretty clear to me that we really needed to have some outdoor environmental education. And that is what UNLEASH is about. And it ranges in age from youth, from say, 7 years old, all the way through college, where UNLEASH tries to help college students and high school students connect up with careers in natural resources or wildlife, fisheries, hydrology, those kinds of environmental sciences.
So how did you get into environmental work in the first place?
Apparently, it was something that I was interested in when I was young. I think it basically started as, like some people, maybe many people, go outdoors to find peace of mind. And in the process of that, you get really interested in what's going on out there. And it's the combination of the enjoyment, the fulfillment, and the wonder and questions that come to your mind about how nature works. And so I guess I just love nature and the processes of nature. And that's what started it. It took me a while to find that there was a career in wildlife. And that's probably the case with many other people. They may not realize that there are these careers in these fields. And so at first I thought there wasn't such and was moving towards some sort of veterinary science area or medical science area until I discovered wildlife biology. And that's what I pursued.
That's actually a coincidence. I had a very similar path. I actually got an option in veterinary medicine because I thought that that was the only real way that I could really interact with other living beings like animals. So it's interesting that we have that in common.
Yes.
Yeah, it is.
And that's one of the things I like to share at the community college, because that's kind of where I did the same thing. I was stumbling around trying to figure things out, and I stumbled into wildlife biology at the community college. Not that they were teaching it there, but that I went through the career files and discovered that a university near there had a program in wildlife biology. And I went, that's it. Yeah.
So I know you personally, mostly from our amphibian surveys at local wetlands. Would you like to talk about that a little? Like, what sort of amphibians do we see here?
Okay. We have a range of amphibians and reptiles, quite a diversity, actually. And for me, that kind of connects into the concept of evolutionary biology and the value and importance of someone understanding evolutionary biology, because it tells you a lot about the ecosystem and how that ecosystem evolved when you think about amphibians. And there's some other species in general, that groups of species that would maybe do the same thing. But in amphibians here are, we have a number of different native frogs, some that are dependent on still water wetlands for breeding and rearing their young, and some that are stream amphibians, okay? And so you've got still water and flowing water species. And then you have terrestrial species, and pretty much all of the terrestrial amphibians that are kind of 100% terrestrial, that they don't breed in a wetland or they don't breed in a stream, which is kind of interesting to think because, you know, we've always been taught, well, amphibians, they have to have water, right, to put their eggs in because they don't have the same kinds of membranes around their eggs that prevent them from drying up, like evolved into reptiles. And so terrestrial amphibians that are 100% terrestrial, like some of the forest salamanders, are really quite unique in that sense. And they actually lay their eggs, however, in these egg sacs in dead wood or deep in a rock area to maintain the moisture. Now, connect that up with what should be the ecosystems out there then, okay? When you think of forest amphibians, these salamanders we're talking about in this case, because the frogs all go to the wetlands to lay their eggs, or they lay their eggs in streams. Okay, so you've got terrestrial salamanders, and you also have some salamanders that are both terrestrial, but they lay their eggs in still water. So, you know, you've got all these combinations of strategies, but all of them, I always like to point out, really describe this forest condition that we've had here for millennia that is being changed from all of the logging activities that are going on. And that's what's really sad. So amphibians are very susceptible to human activities and changes in the microclimate, you know, and the overall climatic conditions that change from removal of the biomass from their habitat. So there are forest salamanders like the clouded salamander, and there's one called the dun salamander and western redback salamander. So there are these different salamanders. Some of them, they'll be in the upslope forest where there's lots of dead wood. Even when fires happen, that creates dead wood. So that's good because that brings in a habitat for them. And then you have some of those salamanders tend to be in more moist riparian habitat, so streamside habitat. So the areas that are downslope, but not stream per se, but they're just much more moist because they're closer to the stream and they're lower in the profile of the slope of the mountain. So that gathers more moisture and bigger trees and yada, yada. A lot of them will be in that area and that habitat. And so that's kind of more your terrestrial amphibians that are pretty much 100% terrestrial. And then you have these amphibians that are both terrestrial and stream or still water wetland breeding. So they live on the land and they'll stay on the land, but then when it's time to breed, they move to wetlands or they move to the streams. Some can be very closely associated with the stream or the wetland, and they don't necessarily move a long ways away from that terrestrially. Others move much further away terrestrially. So for example, I'll go with the stream species and then I'll go into the still water. So with the stream species, they tend to be more riparian, again, near the stream connected. Say for example, there's a frog called the tailed frog, and it's a really unique species that hasn't changed for a long, long time. And it lays its eggs in rocky streams. And then the tadpoles will actually hatch out and they have suction-like mouthparts that eat algae off the rocks. And that's how the tadpoles then grow. And then they'll metamorphose. And they stay pretty much near the streams, including the adults supposedly, but the adults also move on land. And I don't know much about that phase. I'm not sure many people do know their land movement, which is of concern because the streams, they're headwater stream species, not lower stream levels. And headwater streams are not really very protected. And many of the headwater streams have been logged over. And so that creates sedimentation and causes all kinds of changes in the stream structure. So that species is not doing well in a lot of places. And then another stream amphibian is the foothill yellow-legged frog. And that amphibian can be in the larger streams lower down in elevation. more so than the headwater streams, and they're being heavily impacted by lots of the activities of humans, logging, dams, roads, human development in terms of housing and all of that. And so they lay their eggs in the water as well, usually in July, I believe it is. And then their tadpoles need to hatch out and find slow water, which is something hard to find now because we have damaged the terrestrial habitat so much that the stream habitat is downcut and simplified. And what that does is it eliminates things like pools and side channels. And that's the slow water in the stream. And that's where those tadpoles have to be for the foothill yellow-legged frog. They need to have that slow water stream habitat. And so there's not so much of that anymore for that particular species. And then you have situations that cause problems, like we have a non-native invasive bullfrog and non-native invasive bass in those same stream levels, you know, when you're in the larger streams, and other non-native species like that prey upon these tadpoles, right? And they didn't evolve in a situation where they had to deal with these types of species. So that's having an impact on them as well. And then you have situations of water level changes because of human activities, including logging and roads. That makes the flooding, when we have precipitation, it'll make the water rise and rush out much faster. We call that peak flows. And that can flush species out and reduce their habitat condition again. So that's the foothill yellow-legged frog. And the other stream amphibian I can think about, there's a number, but I'm thinking of the main ones here. The southern torrent salamander is a stream amphibian associated with headwater streams. And so it's having the same kind of impacts as the tailed frog in terms of the changes to the stream structure and the stream flows that are then impacting that species' ability to reproduce and maintain populations. And, you know, in a lot of cases, we have what's called head cutting going on in those headwater streams, where it's literally unzipping or unraveling the stream structure and opening it up and causing it to be shallower. And all of that causes it to dry up faster. And so then you end up with zero habitat from drying up. So I'll just say that there are other stream amphibians, but I'll just leave it at that. And so from a stillwater standpoint, we have the northern red-legged frog in the lower elevation. They're really cool looking. They have red legs. Not always will you find one that has that really strong red coloration, but it is sometimes it's really fun to see when they're that way. And it requires both quiet water, wetland of a certain depth with emergent vegetation where it deposits its eggs, which are about cantaloupe size, and fishless. Never have these wetlands that these amphibians lay their eggs in had fish in them, okay, before humans, that is. And so from an evolutionary strategy standpoint, they chose these wetlands that were fishless mainly, so that they could have their young survive. And so that's the kind of characteristic habitat. They are lower elevation, so they're going to be from sea level to around 3,500 feet. Less than that, usually in the 3,200 foot range, but they could be up there in elevation depending on different factors. And then there's another similar species called the Cascade frog, and it looks a lot like the red-legged frog, but it's not the same. It doesn't have the red legs and has different markings, and it is in the higher elevation. It uses very similar habitat, not exactly the same, but very similar habitat as the northern red-legged frog. It's just kind of a different niche, as we call it, right, where it has evolved. Its strategy is the higher elevation. And so it will lay its eggs, but it doesn't attach its eggs to emergent vegetation. Its eggs do look similar to the red-legged frog, but because it doesn't attach, you will find them in different shapes and forms. And they can utilize, or they have utilized, simpler habitats, therefore not associated with emergent vegetation in a wetland. They too, however, have chosen wetlands that, from an evolutionary standpoint, never had fish in them. And so this is an issue because both of those two species have been impacted seriously by humans deciding that those wetlands needed to be made deeper and put fish in, which has caused a lot of other problems associated with the fish besides the fish themselves. And so the other wetland species that utilize those wetland habitats are the northwestern salamander and the rough-skinned newt. And both of those also, you know, they select these areas. The rough-skinned newt you will find in streams with fish. And the northwestern salamander, however, doesn't, to my knowledge, select area. It's the same as the frogs. It selects areas that are historically fishless to lay its eggs. However, it tends to be a little more, I want to say, resilient to the fish. Not that its populations do not decline, but in places where fish have been introduced into these fishless wetlands, you can still find them, perhaps more so than you can find the other species. The newts is similar because they have poison glands that help protect them from fish, but they will lay their eggs in these same wetlands. There is the Pacific giant salamander, and it is both a stream, mostly stream associated species. And it is terrestrial as well, but it tends to be in riparian terrestrial. Now, there's always the chorus frog, and the chorus frog is a species that ranges all the way through everything I've described, but they too need to have these wetland situations to lay their eggs. They tend to, however, lay their eggs in very small wetlands and hope that things don't dry up. So they have a different strategy, but they do also lay in more stable permanent wetlands as well. And they're probably the species that is the most widespread frog species in our area.
They go by another common name too, don't they? What was that other common name for the chorus frog?
Pacific tree frog.
Right.
Yeah. And now they instead refer to it more as a chorus frog. Perhaps it's because it's not so tree associated. But that's common names for you, right?
So I know that here in Oregon, we have some rare species of amphibians. Do we have any endemic species?
Well, first of all, I forgot to mention that we used to have the western spotted frog. And there's also the western toad. And the western spotted frog no longer exists here. And it's, when you say endemic, it's only now located in a very few places, none of which is in the Umpqua Basin, because it was so tied to aquatic habitat. And we have so altered and removed so much of the lowland wetlands where it used to be. It just doesn't exist anymore. It's extinct from our area. So in a sense, that kind of fits an endemic situation in that there's very few populations of it left in the state. And the western toad, same thing. Apparently, that historically, it was even found on the valley bottom floor, but it's no longer there. It is up higher in elevation in the Umpqua Basin, however, and it'll use some of those high elevation lakes and wetlands to reproduce. But it's also impacted by the fish stocking that occurs in these areas. As far as endemic, that's an interesting question because there certainly are some endemic salamanders. There's several species of terrestrial salamanders, the Siskiyou salamander, that have a very small home range. And some of them, they're mostly in the Klamath Basin. They are within the Klamath Basin. And so there's two species of salamander there. And they overlapped because the Klamath province, geological province, comes into the Umpqua. There's some parts of that this species occur in, but it's a very small part compared to further south of us into the Siskiyous. So, you know, endemic. So what does that really mean? I think we're talking about a very small population, right, within a very small area. Those would qualify for that situation. The northern red-legged frog's geographic range, for example, and the Cascade frog's geographic range, and many of those other species that I referred to, go quite a ways up north. I don't remember the geographic range of the tailed frog, but many of those will be into British Columbia, Canada, and then go as far south as Northern California. And the Cascade frog goes further south, I think, in the Sierras, perhaps.
So you mentioned a few challenges that our amphibians face, including invasive animal species. I believe you mentioned bass and bullfrogs. I know that there's also bullhead catfish and pumpkin seed fish, I believe you called them.
Yeah.
How did those get here?
Those got here because areas, it depends on, you know, if you're talking about private land or public land, but they've managed to get to both places. And actually, the actions are very similar in that people, either on private or public land, thought that it would be beneficial to make these wetlands that existed deeper or create wetlands where there were no wetlands on private land, for example, that happened. And in doing so, they thought that it would be great to create fishing recreation. Now, on public lands, that fishing recreation, they were focusing on native trout. On private lands, they were whatever they wanted to put in there, they were going to put in there, right? Such as bass, bullheads, etc. And so you had both of those scenarios going on. Well, on public lands, the native trout didn't survive in those wetlands because the wetlands didn't naturally have the right conditions for that. But they, you know, but because they created that recreation there, people thought there should be fish there, and they illegally introduced the non-natives into it. And part of that, the problem is that they developed road access and recreational access to these places, and then it makes it very easy to illegally introduce a species. And then on private land, well, there's your source, right? You've got people that were putting in ponds and putting in bass and bullheads and all these different fish that sunfish, the pumpkin seed fish is a kind of sunfish like crappie, which is in Galesville. So you have all of these potential sources of non-native invasive fish, and people just took them and put them where they wanted to put them illegally on public lands. And so now you have this widespread problem of these non-native invasive fish in these wetlands, and they're not faring well on public lands in terms of, first of all, they're not great fishing recreation anyway, because they just become these populations of very small stunted fish that eat everything and cause all kinds of other problems in the wetlands. And so it's not even a good fishing recreation situation. But now in the higher elevations, like in the lakes, in the wilderness lakes, the agencies stock native trout there. And that's a problem too for the higher elevation species like the Cascade frog and the Western toad and the Northwestern salamanders and long-toed salamanders and so on. Because again, those fish cause a very significant change in the overall condition. And people bring in non-native fish on top of that. That's been a problem at Diamond Lake forever.
It's a similar story with the bullfrogs as well, wasn't it? That they were hunted for their legs or something along those lines that they were brought here?
Yeah, it's kind of funny because, you know, there's a story about Mark Twain and the California red-legged frog in his book he describes. And you can get a history there in terms of the fact that when Europeans moved into this area, they harvested those frogs, the red-legged frogs, for food to the point where they wiped them out significantly. And so they brought in the bullfrog from other parts of the country where it's native to replace that quote food source. And now we have the bullfrog that's been introduced everywhere. Again, a lot of people don't realize that they're not native and that they can have a significant impact. So they get moved around by people, and now they're pretty substantially impacting many of these places.
And
And now for some brief announcements. We at Umpqua Watersheds are excited to announce our upcoming banquet,
rescheduled to May 1st,
from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. While we will not have an auction this year, we will enjoy food from our local sources, presentations from our committees highlighting our work, and a keynote speech by community dynamo Juliet Palencius. The banquet will be outside behind our building, and we will have awnings and heaters if necessary. Our outback stage will be covered, and we will have live music from 4 to 5 p.m. during happy hour.
If you love to read and would like to discuss environmental topics with fellow bookworms, try Turning Over a New Leaf Book Club. Turning Over a New Leaf Book Club meets over Zoom every other month and will next meet on Saturday, May 28th. The book to be discussed will be Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest by Suzanne Simard. All sessions take place virtually at 5 p.m. on their date. For more information, please email Umpqua Watersheds Director of Education and Outreach, Ryan Kincaid, at her email, ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. That's R-Y-A-N at umpquawatersheds.org.
Or, if you'd like to share your environmental knowledge with the community by being interviewed for an episode of Living Downstream, email me at viviana@umpquawatersheds.org. That's viviana@umpquawatersheds.org.
On the topic of challenges that our amphibians are facing, I heard a few years ago about a fungus, I think it was called a chytrid fungus or something like that, that was wiping out a large number of frogs, but I haven't heard much about it since. Did that ever reach us here in Oregon, to your knowledge?
I'm not aware of it locally. It is still spreading, and there are concerns about several different variations of chytrid fungus. And this would be some great questions for Dr. Mark Hayes. He's a herpetologist, and he would have his fingers probably on the pulse of exactly what's going on with that. Or another would be our United States Geological Service, Biological Survey staff that conduct research and surveys into our native amphibians and their threats. I know that the chytrid fungus has wreaked havoc in many places worldwide. And there was a recent one that was actually starting to, they were concerned that it had arrived to Oregon that was affecting the rough-skinned newt in other places. However, when they did look for that in a couple years past, they did not detect it in Oregon. Doesn't mean that's not changed, but since the last time I paid attention, to my knowledge, that hasn't arrived in Oregon to date. However, there are, and not only with the chytrid fungus, but there are other diseases that can impact amphibians. And this is one of the reasons why hatchery fish are a big issue, because when you put these hatchery fish, which can have diseases, into these lakes and wetlands, you're having a high risk of transferring a disease to the amphibians.
Well, it's good to hear that at least the chytrid fungus hasn't made it very deep into Oregon, if at all. So both you and I have done some work in wetland surveys. And from what I'm familiar with, a lot of the times we don't actually see adult frogs or salamanders. We judge them based on egg mass numbers. So I think I've learned from you that the red-legged frog lays one egg mass per adult, so it's an accurate way of measuring how many adults are present in a wetland. I'm sure you've seen more egg mass types than I have, so could you describe some of the different types of egg masses that we've seen in our work here?
Yeah, that's kind of fun, because if you're out there wandering around in a wetland at the right time of year, you could look for that, and it's fun to see them and to see the development of the embryos. So, for example, the northern red-legged frog egg mass is, as I mentioned earlier, it's about cantaloupe size, and they have one of the largest egg, gelatinous egg casings compared to others. And so what's interesting about that is you can kind of look at the density of little embryos in there, and that can help you decide which species you're looking at. And that egg mass, if you were to touch it, which you don't want to do, but if you maybe just took a little stick or something, then it wouldn't hold together super tightly. And that's one of the ways you distinguish it from the Northwestern salamander egg mass, which is smaller in size, but it can be confused with the red-legged. And remember these, if you see them when they're very fresh, they look like you're looking through a window into the embryo. But over time, they kind of develop a film around them that make them look more whitish or opaque, right? And another thing we know they do is they develop an algae that makes them start to have a green coloration in there. And as I've shared with you, what's really cool about that, and that you can see that really well in the Northwestern salamander egg mass, is that there's actually a symbiotic relationship between the algae. So this is an evolutionary development of this mutual relationship where the algae benefit the development of the embryo. And of course, the egg mass casing is providing a habitat for the algae to grow and be happy. So those two, that's kind of what they look like. The Northwestern salamander, I didn't mention the size, is more like the size of a fist, or a little bit larger, a little bit smaller than the size of a fist. And they like to attach their eggs on a piece of emergent vegetation, just like the northern red-legged frog. So you're going to see them in places where there's emergent vegetation. And that's the same for the chorus frog, is that they attach their eggs to emergent vegetation. They have a similar coloration, obviously, because they're the same kind of basic stuff, the egg mass gel, but the size is much smaller. It's more like you take your finger and you look at what you would wrap around a finger in size, and that's about the right size for that species egg mass to be attached again to some form of vegetation, emergent vegetation, which is that emergent vegetation in a wetland is really critical. And that's what I've been learning over the last 10 years, is the importance of that occupancy and abundance of that wetland vegetation for maintaining good, healthy wetland conditions. And it's obviously very important as egg attachment sites for a number of these species. And another species that you and I haven't seen very much when we've done surveys, but they're out there. It's just that we're not looking in this, I guess, and they're not occurring in the same places, is the long-toed salamander. And it can lay, it does the same thing. It lays its eggs. It looks actually a lot like a chorus frog egg mass, except the size of the eggs are different. The size of the individual eggs are different. They're bigger. And so if those two species, which they could be in the same place, it'd be nice to see them so you could compare the two, because they are different, but pretty hard. Somebody might misidentify something as a chorus frog if they didn't know what they were looking at, if that makes any sense. If there were no chorus frogs and it was just a long-toed salamander egg mass in that area, which can happen. The long-toed salamander can lay their eggs in both ephemeral wetlands as well as in some of the more permanent wetlands. So those are those egg masses. Let's see. And then there's the rough-skinned newt egg. It's not an egg mass, as you well know, because they lay individual eggs in the wetland, and they're very hard to find because they're just an individual egg. And then the western toad lays strings. The egg masses don't really end up being a nice round ball shape, but they'll be more like a group of eggs floating in the water in the emergent vegetation area. And then, you know, the bullfrog, that's similar. They, non-native bullfrog, when they lay their eggs, which would be in May, June, which is much different timing than our natives, they don't lay them in egg masses either, in terms of being, well, it's a mass, but it's not a round ball mass, right? It's more, you'll see them kind of as a flattened, and you might see little bubbly things on the surface, basically, of the eggs floating in the water at the surface level and below.
One of the first wetlands that I surveyed with you, actually, I think it was the first, was a very small pond called Yew Pond. And from what I remember, it was a very well-preserved wetland. It didn't suffer from a lot of the invasives, and we had a really high egg mass count. What are signs, would you say, that a wetland is healthy?
Well, that's a good point. You remember that that didn't have any major structural modification to it. It had nice levels for its size. It had nice levels of emergent vegetation, and it had nice canopy cover around it, but yet you could still have sun that was coming into and reaching the water, right? And so you need a little bit of that, as would naturally occur in a wetland in a forest, because the wetland creates that opening, right, where the sun can reach the water at certain spots in the water. It doesn't have to be the entire water surface itself. It's just that it has to have an area that has that condition. And the water itself, it was very clear, right? Not a bunch of algae in there. And the water source hadn't been significantly modified to the point where it was having trouble maintaining clear, clean water. All of those things, and no introduction of invasives there, right? There wasn't a single invasive animal, and plants were not invasive. That all made that a really nice area. And what's really important about that particular spot, and having experienced that, is that you can get a good reference to what the natural density of these species should be in an area. Imagine, like, if you compared that to the very big wetland called Drew, right? That should have, you know, that just should have so many more, a much higher population than it does. And that's because of the impact of the bullhead catfish there and the bullfrog in terms of how they prey upon the native species.
So something that you and Drew had in common, actually, if I remember correctly, was really great sedge habitat, really great aquatic vegetation. But like you said, the Drew just didn't have the same amount of egg masses, the same quantity of native species that you had. We've actually done some work to try to fix that situation at Drew, though, haven't we? Would you like to discuss what we've done at Drew to try to rectify that situation?
Yeah, it is possible to control and even possibly eliminate these invasive fish and the bullfrog. There are probably some situations where you can't address the bullfrog because of the, there's just too close of a source population that you can't control, that you have no control over if it's on private land or something. In the case we're talking about, these are public land, wetland, and you can get rid of the fish. The idea that you can't get rid of the fish is false in many situations. Perhaps there are some extremely complex, extremely large wetlands that that would not work in. Like, I'm sure there are places that it would be difficult, but there are places where you can, and there are several strategies to do that. So, you know, maybe you can't restore everything to 100% before what it was, but you can have a major restorative result from taking some pretty simple action. With the fish and with, and what's interesting about the bullfrog is that it has to have permanent water for its tadpoles, because its tadpoles need 2 years before they change from a tadpole to a frog, to an adult frog. Whereas all of our native species, so this is where evolutionary biology really becomes valuable again, understanding it, our native species strategy, they only take a certain amount of months before their tadpoles will metamorphose. So if, say, if they lay their eggs in, like the northern red-legged will lay its eggs in, say, January or February, the tadpoles will have changed into little adult juveniles by July. Why? Why is it? And this gets back to what we talked about earlier about the salamanders in the forest. Well, why is it that this species tadpoles have a fairly short window of time at which they are in the water and then change into a juvenile versus this non-native bullfrog that takes 2 years for its tadpole to change, right? Well, it takes 2 years because that species niche is in permanent water, right? Whereas our native species have had to deal with drought. So where does the bullfrog live? In the eastern United States? Well, they have droughts there, but they have way more precipitation, including in the summertime. Here in the West, we don't have that. And we have cycles of drought. Of course, with climate change, we're having much worse cycles of drought now, but we've always had natural cycles of drought. And so our species have adapted to metamorphose before that drought window becomes a problem. And so a lot of these wetlands, in some years, they may maintain surface water year round, but in some years they actually dry up because of drought. However, our species have evolved to respond to that. And so those species have. And so when I look at, okay, what strategy do you have then to get rid of the bullfrogs and the fish? Well, you drain the wetland. But if you're going to drain the wetland, remove the water from the wetland, maybe would be a better way to describe it. You're not going to do that starting in May or June, right? You're going to do that with the natural processes that occur here. So you're going to, if you're going to remove the water from the wetland to dry it up, to get rid of the fish and get rid of the tadpole bullfrogs, then you're going to do that starting after that July timeframe. And you're going to then eliminate the water. That's one way of doing it. And in doing that, of course, you need to make sure that if there's any little pools of water left, that you scoop out the fish in there. The tadpoles will pretty much, they won't make it. But fish, depending on the fish, like the bullhead, sometimes because the wetland may not dry up completely, you may need to actually get in and access the muddy spots where they're concentrated and remove the bullhead from there. So that's the strategy we used at Drew. We have not completely succeeded. The other thing we did is remove all the adult bullfrogs. And there are lots of different techniques as to how to do that. And then the other thing we did at Drew, besides removing the adult bullfrogs, was that we knew when they laid their eggs, right? So we were also going in and removing the egg masses of the bullfrogs. So we were addressing the bullfrog at all three of those life stages. And then with the fish, the best we can do is just drain the wetland and remove any remaining fish. Or if you're lucky, you could drain the wetland and it takes care of itself. The other technique that has been used, and I have not personally been involved in any use of it, but there is a natural chemical derived from a plant in South America, and it's called rotenone. And you can take the rotenone and apply it into the water, and anything that has gills will suffocate. And that's another way that you can eliminate the fish and the tadpoles of the bullfrog. And like I said, pretty much everything that is native can move out of the water or has already moved out of the water. So that's another, you would want to time that similar to what if you timed it to drain the wetland. Now, like I say, there's some places that may be very complex and difficult to drain. So it doesn't work everywhere, but we should be definitely focusing on those places where it does work, because what is of concern is two things. One is that these non-native species are widespread all across both public and private land. And so they are having huge impacts on these native amphibian populations. And to the point where if you had any kind of natural kind of disaster, like a disease was introduced, we could literally wipe out pretty much the entire population.
Another method that I don't think you mentioned is we had some moderate success with fish trapping there at Drew, didn't we?
Oh, yes.
We caught several hundred.
Yeah, that's true. It doesn't eliminate, right? It doesn't eliminate, but it sure did show us that the difference. And it's funny because you mentioned it sure did reduce the population to the point where it did allow the few red-legged that were still left there to have successful reproduction. So we went from years of monitoring where we only had 1 to 5 egg masses to 63 egg masses of northern red-legged frog. And we were utilizing that species as the indicator species because it was so sensitive to all of these impacts. And so it's hard to have all the time and energy and effort to look at everything in a system, but this was a means by which we could kind of address the invasive species and monitor the success of the system and the wetland restoration associated with monitoring the northern red-legged frog egg masses. And so, yeah, we captured quite a few and removed them from the site. It doesn't completely control everything, but it sure showed us, number one, there were people who didn't necessarily think that that wetland was out of its normal range of condition, so to speak. You know, people, you just, if you walk upon a wetland and you don't know what you're looking at, and you only get 5 egg masses in this big wetland, you might think that's normal, right? Because that happened to be a little bit on the higher elevation scale for northern red-legged frog anyway. However, it's not relative to where it is in terms of its location in the southern area of the Umpqua and all of that. It should have thousands there, but you can't believe that unless you see some change. And that's what we were actually able to do, is show the difference that is being affected there by the occupancy of the bullhead fish and the bullfrog, and how that is really having such a huge impact on the population. And so, yes, you look at Drew and you realize all the sedge habitat it has there, it should have hundreds and hundreds of egg masses of these native species there.
U Pond was just a fraction of its size. And I remember, I still have the note where we took the egg count and we found 103.
Yes.
Egg masses there. And it's a tiny little pond.
It's tiny. It's boy, it's probably, I'm trying to think of a fraction of Drew, what fraction it would be, 1/12 the size. You know, I didn't even think it was that, even smaller than that, right?
Right.
And that just goes to show you. And Drew is very nice habitat. There's should be full of them.
Well, Drew may be struggling, but I think that probably the least healthy wetland that I've personally seen going out with you on your surveys was Blue Bluffs. Blue Bluffs seems to be in very rough condition, or at least it was the first time that I went out there. What's causing all of that at Blue Bluffs?
Yeah, and that's on public land. And I really encourage people to be contacting the Umpqua National Forest and asking them to restore that wetland back to its functioning condition. There's so many things that have impacted that place, and it's possible to restore it. So I'll go into the kind of the chronology. The first thing that happened there was Blue Bluffs. It's called Blue Bluffs because there's this beautiful bluff feature, columnar basalt bluff feature. And immediately adjacent to that is this wetland. And there's a series of wetlands in this whole entire area. But these two, the wetland that's just at the base of Blue Bluffs and then just the one down below it, are the more substantial wetlands of the ones that are there. So they're like the population source, or they should be the population source, kind of the security of these native amphibian species. Well, they went in first and they decided to build a road in there and utilize the base of the cliff for a rock pit, where they then harvested the rock, ground it up and put it on roads. So that created a problem there. Then they did a major amount of logging all around that area in the 1950s and 60s, and that created a lot of problem. From sediment input, the roading and the logging and lack of good vegetation conditions. And then in the 1980s, they went in and dredged it with the concept or idea that creating a fishing recreation was a good thing. And that's why they dredged it, thinking that that would maintain more permanent water and that you could create this fishing recreation. And that dredging actually eliminated all of that emergent vegetation that keeps the water healthy and clean, and caused the riparian habitat to be lost. So there's not a lot of diversity of plants in the adjacent land around it, not a lot of shrubs and high canopy closure with leafy things like big leaf maple and alder or Oregon ash, those lots of willow. Those are the things that should be there that are gone. And so you've got major structural changes there. And in addition to the structural changes, at first, the Forest Service, after they did the dredging and everything, they put in native trout for that, quote, fishing recreation opportunity. But in doing that, the native trout didn't survive because that's not where they're supposed to be. And the water couldn't maintain a high enough oxygen level. And with all of the logging and everything that had been done around there and the sediment input, that all factored into causing the problem with the oxygen, and all of that factored into causing what we call eutrophication, right? Where you start getting algae blooms, and that a lot of the nutrients that would have been on the land were making their way into the wetland from the result of logging. And so you have that perfect storm of nutrient input and still water, and all of that causes low oxygen levels, and algae blooms, and dying algae causes that oxygen level loss. And so the trout didn't make it, but the Forest Service continued to maintain the place as a recreational site, and that facilitated the illegal introduction of these fish that are now in there that are invasive. And that's the pumpkin seed fish. It could be that there are other fish in there, but as far as our fish trapping data indicate, that's what currently is at least dominating the system there. And as you noted last year, it's all these tiny, just hundreds and hundreds of tiny little pumpkin seed fish. And all of that adds more nutrients into the water and enhances that perfect storm, because you've got all the fish in there adding nutrients. And then the fish also eat things that were not meant to be eaten in these wetlands, because they all evolved without the fish. And so you don't have all of the organisms in there that would clean the water, right? So that is why you have such a bad situation there in both the upper and the lower wetland. And on top of all of that, because of the recreational access and the fact that it had once been a rock pit, there seems to be a public interest to bring your rifles or your guns to target practice there. And that is a problem, because we have the western pond turtle, which is in trouble as well. And their populations are in major decline, and they will sun on the logs in the water. And unfortunately, people find that to be a great opportunity to target practice, not on a target, but on a turtle. And so another problem with recreational access is this impact to the species there from that activity as well. And the recreationists that have gone there have trashed the place, oftentimes not properly using, there's no outhouse there. And so people don't use that properly, and they just leave a big mess. So there's a number of reasons that that place is so out of whack. And the sad part about all this too, is that that place should have beaver present, and beaver should be affecting that entire water catchment there, to where there would be much better, cleaner water and storage of water. But also the recreational activity there and the access also impacts the ability of beaver to maintain a population there.
So what can people do
to help our local wetlands?
Well, in the case of, say, for example, Blue Bluffs, contact the Umpqua National Forest send them a message, send them an email, send them a postcard to ask them to restore those wetlands and to eliminate them as recreational sites, because that will not ever function properly if we don't give those wetlands their space. And also be aware of what species are non-native and invasive, and make sure that you're not adding any of these species by transferring them around. I know it's easy to do that with little kids when, oh, they catch a bass and then you put it in your aquarium for a while, then you don't want it anymore. So you think you can just put it back in the system, and that's not good. So recognize that these are non-native invasive species. And another part of that is that there are a number of aquatic mollusk species, snails, and other kinds of diseases like the chytrid fungus that you can spread if you go from one place to another and you're wearing chest waders, or you have fishing equipment, or you have a boat or whatever. It's entirely possible to transfer these organisms from one body of water to another, even if there's a fairly decent time frame in between when that equipment isn't in the water. You need to really clean your equipment. And I want to emphasize that if you wear chest waders, make sure you clean out the bottom of the chest wader boot or whatever boots you use, such that there's absolutely zero amount of mud or gravel or anything in there. And there is a sanitation process that you use by using either bleach or another substance that kills viruses. And so it's real important. You can always contact Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and ask what you need to do to clean your equipment, and they can give that information to you. What else can people do?
I could suggest one. So you mentioned earlier kids. So I think that brings up another good one, which is education, environmental education, and making sure that our young people have the knowledge that they need to grow up to be conservationists and environmentally minded people. Would you like to discuss how you've done that, for example, and how other people can get involved in that?
That's a great one. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, because our young people really can get connected to the outdoors, and it makes for a healthy childhood. And it's a great opportunity to learn and to teach about these issues. And Umpqua Natural Leadership Science Hub has outdoor youth camps. And this is something that others could do, where you teach them about the non-native invasive species and you teach them about the native species, and you get them literally in touch with them and in touch with their habitat, and teach them how to see the habitat and to see the differences of healthy versus not healthy, so that they can begin to understand what humans need to be able to do to protect and to restore those places. One of the things that we have done in our youth camp here in Myrtle Creek is we spend time next to the Myrtle Creek proper, the main stem of the Myrtle Creek that runs through the little town of Myrtle Creek. And we take them to the park there, and we go into the creek and we look at the organisms in the creek, and we identify the native and we identify the invasive. And one of the things that is an issue now with the invasive species there is the crayfish. There's a native crayfish, and then there's a number of different non-native species of crayfish that have been introduced. And those non-native crayfish are causing all kinds of trouble. It's just amazing to me the enjoyment they have in those experiences. There's adult supervision, plenty of safety oversight, and the youth get to just really look at all the different nooks and crannies and habitat conditions out there and enjoy it and learn about it.
So I think that's a good place to wrap it up. Thank you so much for appearing on Living Downstream, Cindy.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it.